And welcome everyone to a very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man. Super excited as always.
Absolutely. Joining us today is veteran cinematographer Stephen Poster, ASC. Stephen has compiled an eclectic mix of credits throughout the years, stretches over a wide range of genres and styles. He's worked with Maverick indie director Richard Kelly on the cult classics Donnie Darko and Southland Tales, as well as the underrated sci-fi thriller The Box. He shot the provocative Los Angeles sexual drama Spread, Ridley Scott's Someone to Watch Over Me, Rocky V, Big Top Pee Wee, and the 80s classics Strange Brew and The Boy Who Could Fly, which I remember vividly from my childhood. Early second unit credits include Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Blade Runner, Starman, Big Trouble in Little China, as well as camera operation duties on Robert Altman's brilliant 1978 comedy drama A Wedding. Stephen currently serves as president of the International Cinematographers Guild, and he was a past president of the American Society of Cinematographers. His upcoming projects for next year include the horror sequel Amityville, The Awakening, a new Richard Kelly movie, which I know Frank and I will be excited to find out as much as we can about, and the indie drama All Good Things. So welcome to the show, Stephen. It's an honor to speak with you today. Thanks so much for coming on.
What a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is incredible. Looking over your credits, it's hard to know where to begin because your credits are so vast and you've stretched over almost, every genre that I can think of looking over them.
I missed two that I really am sorry that I did, unfortunately. And one of them was a full-on musical. I've done a lot of music work. I did the music video for Like a Prayer with Madonna, but I've never done an entire musical straight out. I did a TV show that was a musical. The other one is I was working with on a movie called not The New Kids. I was working on a movie with a very famous physical effects guy. And at one point, he put his arm around me and said, "Steve, you're pretty good. I think you're ready to do a war movie." And I've never done a war movie. So those are two genres I've missed.
You mentioned Like a Prayer. That music video, that's probably my favorite Madonna song. And that music video is fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, it was it was 3 days of actual creative wonder, and she was fabulous to work with.
How did you come about that project?
My agent called me, and there I was. So it was a delight.
Wow, that's fantastic! I love that music video. We're gonna post a link to that when we post this podcast.
Right.
Everybody, I know everybody's seen that and loves that song.
And I had no idea that it would be as controversial as it was. They said to me, "All right, we're going to go burn these crosses on San Pedro Hills." And I, a little Jewish kid, what do I know? And I said, "Sure, okay, we'll burn the crosses." And there it was. They banned it in Italy, of course.
Well, I mean, there's kind of like a black Jesus in there.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, I mean, probably a lot of people that don't like that. But yeah, no. I just wanted to say that's awesome, and I love
right,
it.
Thanks.
And you got a chance to do. In terms of a musical, I know the whole film wasn't, but you have that really surreal, awesome, wonderful musical interlude in Southland Tales, which I'm sure we'll cover. In as much depth as we can. That was also a very cool little bit there in that film.
I am so glad that you guys appreciate Southland Tales, because I think it's a fabulous movie. I think it's a real sleeper, and people just don't understand it. They think it's something that it isn't.
people think that it's something that it isn't. It's challenging. It's, you know, I'm not going to lie. I don't think that it's for everybody. I think that there's a certain type of person that is going to sit down and just not be able to digest everything that's being thrown at them. And it sort of might provoke confusion or frustration, and then there's no willingness to go back and watch it again. It's a movie that needs to be experienced multiple times. It's not a sit down once, watch it and be done. And you know, and that speaks to the great ideas at work at the screenplay level. But in terms of how you approach the film, I guess we can just jump into that. We'll bounce all over the place. But I have long been completely intoxicated by the visual sense of Southland Tales, the fluidity of the imagery, how you captured that last 30 minutes, that like sort of nocturnal fantasia of events that are going on. What are some of your earliest memories of getting involved in Southland Tales, and like maybe the first time you read the script? I don't know. You know, we always ask our guests when they read scripts, do they see them in, you know, camera terms, or are you just reading it as a script right off the bat? What can you tell us about Southland Tales?
Well, first of all, in terms of watching it, my wife is a psychoanalyst, and she's very critical and has a wonderful eye on top of it. She, the first time she saw it, she had no idea what she was watching and was critical of it. You know, not of the photography. She liked that. But she was critical of the movie. Then we happened to go, we went to the premiere screening, and she watched it again and said to me afterwards, she says, "I know what it is. It's a dream. If you try and figure it out, you're going to lose it. Just go with it like it's a dream." Well, of course, psychoanalysis, you know. But that's kind of the way I describe it at times. It really has a flow to it that's very surreal. I describe it as an absurdist political movie. It's almost Dada-esque in its approach. The way it was marketed, it was marketed like a horror film or something. It was just completely stupid. It should have been marketed as a political movie, in the sense that it came out, it was made while Obama was running for office for his first term. It would have been perfect if you would have said, if they would have marketed as this political piece, it would have been seen in a completely different light, I think. So, you know, when I first read the script, Richard turned in about 140 page script, and as he had promised me, he said, "You know, we did Donnie Darko in 25 days. We're going to get more time on my next movie," and we did. We got 27 days, which is significant in a way, but there was a lot to do. I was pretty confident that we could accomplish it, because I know how Richard and I worked together after the first one. But the producers and of course the Bond company, there's always a Bond company on an independent movie, came in and said, "No, you have to turn in a 90 page script." So we had to lose 50 pages from the script. So the script was not molded in a way that was linear, and that you could really understand what the narrative thread was based on that. But we turned in a 90-page script, and they said, "Okay, we can go with it." But I don't think that the producers really understood what we were trying to do, which was okay. They let us do it, and we got away with it. But one of the things that you commented on was the music video, they said to us, we were shooting on Santa Monica Pier, which was, by the way, the site of my very first Hollywood movie, Blood Beach, another interesting movie, which we hope to do a Blu-ray on someday. we had one day on that pier, and we had to accomplish it. Well, Rich, and they said, we don't want to do the video. We can't do the video. We'll never accomplish it. We'll never have time to do it. You can't do that. And Richard and I went into that location, which was an arcade, and figured out how to accomplish three shots, accomplish the entire song. And we did it. We did it in about, I don't know, 2.5, 3 hours. The place had been sort of prepared to shoot in anyway, because we had that scene in there where he gets the drugs, you know. And so it had the basis of the lighting that we wanted. I had my guys tweak it a bit for the music video, and we went in and shot it in three shots, probably no more than two takes for every shot. And that became that classic piece. But it's the kind of way that Richard and I work. We have a shorthand that's just wonderful to experience. We're like two little brothers arguing about things sometimes. I want the camera here. No, I want the camera here. But we always come into a conclusive and cohesive idea of where we want to tell what we want to tell the audience with every shot. It's a joy. It's a real joy.
Wow. How did you come about working with him originally?
It's an interesting story. I had, for various reasons, been a little bit out of the market for almost 3 years. One of the, and I say the market with meaning the Hollywood market, one of the things that took me out of the market was that I went to France for 7 months to shoot a movie with one of the greatest directors I've worked with, Patrice Leconte. It was a French movie. I was the only American involved. Patrice and I had done commercials together for many years, and he wanted me to shoot one of his features. He wanted me initially to shoot Ridicule, and unfortunately the French government would not let me in because, you know, they're very protective. Then there was a second movie that he wanted me to shoot, and they wouldn't let me in. And by the third time, my colleagues and friends in the French Society of Cinematographers went to the government and said, this is too embarrassing, you have to let him in. And I think to this day, I'm still the only American to ever shoot a French movie in France for a French director. It was a complete adventure. It was Jean-Paul Belmondo and Alain Delon and Vanessa Paradis in a big action-adventure comedy, which opened the same day as Titanic and got killed and never came here, unfortunately. So I was basically for 7-8 months, I was out of this market. And if you're out of sight and out of mind in this market, it's not good. And on top of that, I came back to some personal stuff and I was doing commercials. So for a total of about 3 years, I had not done a feature film. My friend Thomas Siegel. Thomas Newton Siegel was offered this movie because he knew the line producer, and turned it down. He was busy on something else and said, you know, I know my friend Stephen Poster is very interested in finding a movie. I think he'd be interested in doing this. Now, it was a small movie. It was, you know, about a $4 million movie, 25 days. None of that bothered me. I read the script and I fell in love with the script. The script was so, well, you know, it became the movie, and it really was good. So I went into the meeting knowing that I wanted to do the movie. I walked into this meeting with Richard and Sean McKittrick, his partner producer, and I saw that Richard was very nervous and he was kind of pacing back and forth. And I said, Richard, stop for a second. I said, look at me. I said, Richard, from this point on, we're the same age. Don't consider my experience or my age as any different than you and I being partners. And all of a sudden, I saw him take a deep breath and relax. And from that moment on, we were together. And I said in the meeting, I said, I want to, I'll accept this job if you and I can spend 3 or 4 days together alone reading the script and trying to understand what we need to do. And they agreed to that, even though it was a short prep. They agreed to that, and we sat down for 4 days, and we read the script in a way that we both began to understand what it was that we wanted to tell the audience with every scene, every shot, every sequence, every beat in the movie. We had a complete, and we didn't storyboard. I'm not a big fan of storyboards unless it's for an action sequence or a visual effects sequence. And we bonded in those 4 days. We bonded in a way that you almost rarely get to do with a director, because you don't get that kind of time alone before a movie's about to be shot, because, you know, there's thousands of other questions to answer. But we actually had those days. We understood the script in a way that in 25 days we knew exactly what we needed to get every day. And that was a real joy, because we had fun on that movie every single day. And we had the pressure of the producers, the actors' schedules. It was not easy, but we were of course mandated to not go overtime. We had 12-hour days, and they were ready to cut the cord at any point, pull the plug, as it were. And but because we had this knowledge of the script and knowledge of what we wanted to say, we knew every day what was an absolute demand that we had to get to tell the story and what was gravy. And if we were getting close to the end and we needed to throw something out, we had the ability to do that. So that was kind of our MO of the way we put it together.
It's crazy to think that you shot both Donnie Darko and Southland Tales in under 30 days. Because they both just seem so, like, especially Southland Tales. I mean, Donnie Darko, fine, maybe a little bit more contained. Southland Tales has a sprawling epic feel. And to hear that movie essentially was shot in less than a month is mind-boggling.
Yeah. when I look back at it, it seems like an impossible task. But, you know, when you're in the middle of it and you go for it and you do the best you can, it worked. It just worked.
So this is an interesting thing to note too, because you said that you were, you know, you hadn't done some stuff for a bit. You get hooked up with Richard Kelly. You do Donnie Darko. It's a like you said, $4.5 million film, a true independent movie. And then according to your credit list, the next film that you shoot is Stuart Little 2, which had to have been at least a $100 million, if not more, special effects heavy CGI, you know, sort of like franchise, you know, mini franchise picture, if you will. What was that like in terms of going from a small project to a massive one, which would then utilize even more special effects?
It's interesting. I don't know. I don't think of it in those terms. It took a long time to convince the producers and the director on Stuart Little 2 that I was the one to shoot that movie. A couple of months went by, and it was a bit agonizing, but of course that's the that's the nature of the game in that sense. I think that I've had enough experience, especially early on in my career, with visual effects, Close Encounters, Blade Runner, other movies that I've done, that they don't scare me in a way that if I hadn't had that experience, I might be a little bit uncomfortable in that sense. So I really just accepted it as a movie. Now, I had done a couple of weeks of work on Stuart Little 1, so I knew the cast of characters, and the production manager on 2 was a good friend of mine who I'd worked with over the years, and he was very instrumental in helping me get that work. I went into it. I had the director's ear. He knew me, and I went through level after level of producer discussions. They didn't know me well enough to know that I could pull this off, and that I loved the idea of what it was. It was very early on in the world of digital. That did not affect me in any way, because I had been working with digital and helping the development of digital from about 1990 on, and had a good understanding of it. We were shooting film, of course, but it was going to be digitized, and we had all of these digital effects to do. The visual effects supervisor was completely skeptical of me, because I came in with a language of understanding it, and he thought I was going to take over and try and you know, boss him around. After the first time we sat down at a monitor and started working together on some of this stuff, he realized that I was ready to partner with him, and that was fun. So I got through all of these discussions one after the other after the other. Head of the studio, production, associate producers, executive producers, and I got to the very final producer discussion. This was after the director had finally, after a month, accepted me. And I got to the very final producer level, and they sat me down in a room with several other people, Doug Wick and Lucy, and said to me, just off the cuff, "Well, what are you going to make this movie look like?" And in all that time, I had not thought about this. I was just concentrating on trying to get through the business, you know. And I don't know where it came from. Out of my mouth came, "Well, you know, the first movie, they were just meeting Stuart, and it was very subdued. It had a beautiful, subdued look to it, very desaturated. This is 3 years later, and Stuart is part of the family. Everybody loves each other. Everybody's very much a family. And so this should be a sunny movie." And they said, "Oh, that's a great idea." Totally off the top of my head. And I made it a sunny movie. And it was, if you look at it, it's so unnatural in some ways. An interior of the house, which we built totally on stage, the interior of the house, there's sun coming in every window all the time. And of course, it gives it a very up feeling, a very uplifted feeling. It's really fun, and I had the ability on stage with those kind of resources to create an entire block of New York City, making it a sunny day, and we ended up, it was very fortunate in some ways, we ended up going to New York to shoot in Central Park. We had 6 days of shooting there. Those 6 days were the moment when, in spring, Central Park has this kind of pale green leaves budding on the trees. It was sunny. It was beautiful. And it had a magical feeling to it. So that was able to carry on the idea of it being sunny.
Yeah, both of those films are real gems for kids and families. I saw both of them. I loved them both. And they're the kind of movies that even – I mean, they came out about 15 years ago now. Like, they – you know, we've had this conversation on other podcasts about kids' movies and about the progression of, you know, the digital language with Pixar and with a lot of sort of these really like aggressively stylized things that have come out. They're very frenetic, and those two movies are sort of throwbacks to a more, you know, they still have the great special effects from modern times, but they have like sort of a more quaint and honest feel to them. And I can honestly remember thoroughly enjoying both and always saying to myself, you know, how snazzy they both looked.
Thank you. I had a hand in the first one. I did the night sequence where Stuart is in the woods or in the park in Central Park at night, and the bad cats are coming after him. And it was all done on stage. It was fun, and that got me. That really got me in the second movie. Now remember, this was a director who had never directed live action before this. He had done Lion's King, King, and as an animated movie. So there was a real kind of bonding of helping him understand the process of live action shooting. That was great. We really enjoyed each other that way, and he trusted me.
I wanted to bring up Daddy Daycare.
Oh yes,
because that's a film that I love, and that's one of my favorite Eddie Murphy performances of, you know, recent years. And I've always loved that film, and it's always made me laugh.
Yeah, yeah. It had a quality about it that was completely goofy. And well worth it. It was a lot of fun to work on.
How'd you get involved with that?
Well, let's see. Oh no, I know how. I remember how. Again, a friend of mine was. I think it was Darren Okada. To remember back, but was asked to do the movie, and he was booked. And my agent introduced me to the director, and we met, and Darren Okada helped me out and convinced him that I would be good for him. And in fact, Steve Carr then hired me, and we went about making the movie. It's there's your dog. Look at that. in some ways it was a rather luxurious shoot because Eddie has the ability to take his time and do what he wants when he wants to do it. So we had to be prepared, especially on stage at all times, to turn in any direction. So they built that house, the interior of that house, and part of the exterior was built on stage again. It's one of the fun things I think a director of photography gets to do on stage, which is build an exterior or a daylight environment in a completely interior world. And because we had to be prepared to turn in any direction at any time, I had to light the entire house and be prepared to just go in any direction at any time. And unfortunately for the producers, cost a little more money to have all that equipment ready and all the backings ready for it. But we could swing any way that Eddie wanted to go at any given time, and it was fun to do. We had 14 kids. I think it was 14 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds. None of them were doubled. Nor a lot of times you will hire twins to play a part because you only get. Especially for you only get about 4 hours a day with a 4-year-old by law, and that's a good thing because you know you don't want to abuse the child. But we had no twins. We had 4 hours a day to work with these kids, and we had you know somewhat of a limited amount of time to work with Eddie. So it was luxurious in that way that we really had the time to do the things that we wanted to do in terms of the technical and the resources.
That's great. I always loved that film. That film is just
it's goofy.
It is. It's goofy, but it's sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I agree. very sweet, very very a very alive movie. And I think you know, again, the fact that we had these 4 year olds and great studio teachers working with us, and the parents were actually good. You know, a lot of times with a smaller group of kids, you get, you know, stage parents, that can be a little bit difficult. But these were a group of parents and teachers that kept these kids alive the whole time, and really there was no drama in that sense. You know, it's a 4 year old. How do you tell a 4 year old, okay, here's your motivation? You know, so to Steve Carr's credit, he did a good job of keeping it together and keeping the comedy flowing. And Eddie, of course, is when Eddie is on, he's a genius.
Yeah, certainly is. I love how he's been able to transcend back and forth a little bit, where he gets dramatic. Dreamgirls is fantastic.
Oh God, he's just. I wish he would do more of that.
I know. I agree.
You know, he's such a talent, and he's. I think he's underused in the drama, the world of drama.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
So you've done a lot of children or family films as well. Is that something that you seek out, or is that something that kind of comes to you?
You know, it's really the luck of the draw. You know, there are, at any given time, there are a certain number of scripts that are available to do that you as an artist would fit into that moment in your career and in your genre, and in terms of, I mean, it's a selling. It's you have to have the ability to sell yourself into a genre. Unless someone comes to you, unless a director comes to you and says, "I want you for this picture," like Richard and I mean, Richard does now, of course, and other directors that I've worked with, but. It's for the most of the time you're meeting people for the first time, or you've met them socially, and you have to make them comfortable with who you are and how you're going to run a set. The Amityville was a very interesting example of that. I had met Frank, the director on Amityville. I'd met him casually, briefly, in a sushi restaurant over the Christmas holidays. We were having a little surprise birthday party for my wife, and when we finished, we were walking out, and there was this couple sitting at the sushi bar with a beautiful, beautiful young girl, a child, sitting between them. And this was a very friendly sushi bar. We go there a lot. And my wife looked at the little girl and said, "What a beautiful young girl." And they started talking. And then I started talking to Frank. And he says, "Well, the owner says you come here a lot." And I said, "We do. And I've been doing it for years." And he introduced himself and said, "What do you do?" I said, "I'm a cinematographer." And he said, "Well, I'm a director." So we exchanged cards and said goodbye, and that was it. A month later, he called me up, and he said, "I'm doing the new Amityville for Blumhouse. Would you be interested in shooting it?" And I said, "Yes, I would." And we had coffee one afternoon, and he gave me the job right there. So I mean, it's like, how fortuitous is it that you run into somebody in this town in a sushi restaurant, you know?
Right.
Yeah, and you got. I was just taking a quick look, actually, because I've seen the first Amityville. I've seen, you know, the original, the remake. This one's got Jennifer Jason Leigh, Kurtwood Smith,
yep.
And Frank and I are fans of both. Looks like it's got, like you said, produced by Jason Blum for his Blumhouse Pictures. What can you tell us about this movie, considering that this is something that a new project for you that's coming out next year?
Well, it's you know, I looked at some of the earlier work that Frank Calhoun had done, and you judge a director, if you don't know the person, you judge them on their past work, and then making phone calls to people that you know that had worked with him, and it was kind of a fortuitous pairing, because he trusted me. You know, I have a few credits behind me, but he trusted me, and I learned very quickly to trust him. It was a delightful relationship in that sense. Blumhouse, wonderful company, no money, but they're honest about it. They pay you. It's a union job, and they give you the parameters. There's no ambiguity about what you have to do at any given time. And that was kind of fun to do it that way. Again, we started out with a script that was 22 days long. You know, 22 days was going to be a real stretch for that. But a week before we were supposed to start shooting, the executive producer, Bob Weinstein, came in and said, "I'm not happy with the script. I want to rewrite the script entirely." And we had to shut down for about a week before we started shooting. We weren't shooting yet. And while they rewrote the script came in. It was a little more heavy than the original script, so they increased us 26 days. It seems to be a magical number, 25, 26, 27 for me. I don't know. I guess my earlier television days got me prepared to do that kind of a schedule. Those 26 days were allowed us to really – to really get into it and do the movie. It was quite fun in that sense. It was shot last summer, a while ago, and the movie, I think the movie, it tested really well. It wasn't released at the moment it was supposed to, for whatever reason, so now it's coming out next year. But it's I think it's a good one. I think it's really good. It's a horror film, and it's a psychological horror film. It's not as bloody as say what's coming out from Eli Roth these days, who is another friend and another terrific director, but it doesn't have the gore. But it is scary as hell. It really is. It's just terrific.
I wanted to bring up some of your earlier work when you were first getting started, because you know, Frank and I are big fans of Ridley Scott, and we can't help but notice that you did some what appears to be second unit work or camera department work on Blade Runner. Which then led to you working with him on Someone to Watch Over Me, which I actually revisited last night. And I just wanted to talk to you about how you got hooked up on Blade Runner and what some of your recollections are from that, and also Someone to Watch Over Me.
You know, it's fun. Blade Runner was in production for quite some time. And I got called in ostensibly for one night's work. There was a shot that Ridley wanted that they had attempted to do two or three times before. He was never happy with it. And my agent happened to be friends with Ridley and at the time, and knew him, and said, "Why don't you let Steven try it?" And I got the job for one night's work. That was a shot that has become kind of iconic. It's the shot where Harrison's car, which they call the spinner, was driving through the white tunnel with all the lights spinning around it, and the white tile tunnel, Second Street tunnel downtown in L.A. And the studio was kind of unhappy, to say the least, with the situation that they had continued to try and get this, and nobody had satisfied Ridley to do this. It was a second unit shot. He wasn't going to go out and do it, but he described it. I went to Jordan Cronenworth, the director of photography, who was a wonderful, human being, and very, very generous, and got the parameters of what he thought should be done. Went out. The studio said, we're not going to give you any lighting. We're not going to give you anything. You got a water truck, you got a grip truck, and a very small crew, and a camera, and go out and do it. I didn't see the ones before. I just went out and judged it on my own. Went into the tunnel, and I realized I didn't have any lighting equipment, but the tunnel has its own lighting, and very dim, but it was white. So I had the idea. I took every truck and every car, the crew car that came out with us, I had them drive to the other side of the tunnel and line up in the tunnel and put their brights on. So and they were right out of shot. You didn't see the lights, but it created kind of a swirling effect on the tile. And I put the camera on the ground on a sandbag, put a very wide angle lens on it, and let the car drive by several times. And we had wet it down. It was very hot out at the time. It was the summer. And we needed to wet down the tunnel to get the reflections and get the reflections on the road. And that was it. I went back and called up the next afternoon after I woke up, because we were out there all night. They said, can you come in to work tonight? And I said, sure, but it was only a one-day job. They said, Ridley wants you to come back. And we started, it was toward the end of the production. It was the production itself was fraught with angst between the crew and Ridley and the crew, and it was a time when I think it was his early on when he had done most of his work in England and not done much in America except for commercials, and so there was a tension going on. I was, of course, the new kid on the block. I was like a kid in a candy store, and every night they were doing two or three shots of these big, huge visual effects. The end scene with Blatty up on the roof with the spinning blades that was an invention that Ridley came up with on the spur of the moment, which is what he does. There were other things that needed to be done, little scenes, shots, this and that, essentially a second unit. But Ridley and I would walk, would while they were setting up these long shots, very time consuming. Ridley and I would go to another stage where there was a scene ready to shoot, and we wouldn't shoot entire scenes that ended up in the movie. We did the scene where Joanna Cassidy, the Snake Lady, beats up Harrison Ford in his dressing room, and then she runs out and gets killed. We did that almost that entire scene as a second unit scene, although it was with principals. And I got to do a lot of those kinds of things. The original stuff of the stunt double going through the window after that shot. I did shots like Pris doing the tumbling into the frame and putting her hand in the boiling water. A lot of incidental stuff like that really was iconic to the movie, and I was on for the next three or four weeks, and really got to know me. From that point on, he had me do the testing on his next movie, which was Legend. We were doing it doing the testing here, but of course he was going to go to England to shoot, and I couldn't. They couldn't get me in. So I didn't get a chance to shoot that movie. But then he came back. We did some commercial work together. And then he had the challenge of trying to convince the studio that he could, in fact, do a movie on budget and on schedule, and a smaller movie, and that was someone to watch over me. He asked me to do it, and I loved the script, and thought, you know, here's an opportunity to do something really noir, and to coin a phrase, and we did, and we did it on schedule, on budget, and had a terrific time working with Ridley. Ridley is you know, he is a genius. He can, you can walk in, you can prepare for an idea, and walk in, and he will, in a couple of thoughts, turn you around into something else that you didn't plan for, but worked much better for the scene. He has this ability to think so fast and so creatively, and you have to be able to stay up with him. If you can stay up with him, he is so respectful and so helpful. And what I did was I prepared the crew, the crews, because we did work here in Los Angeles and we did work in New York. And the idea was always have two or three solutions to every problem, because it's going to change. And once the crew understood that, they went along with it, and they understood that we, you know, we might not be shooting what we're preparing, but we will be able to do it because there's alternatives available to us. And I had a wonderful gaffer that I had been working with for a number of years, Jim Planet. We walked into every situation with alternative ideas. So that was how we kept up with his brilliant thinking. So thank you. I like that movie.
yeah, that movie, both Nick and I are both huge fans of that film.
Yeah, me too. It was fun to do, and working with Lorraine Bracco, it was the first time she had ever done a movie. She was just so fresh and alive that she brought a real quality to it that I love to this day.
So tell us your next collaboration with Richard Kelly. Can you tell us much about that?
I really can't. I can tell you that it's called Soulmates. It's again a fabulous script. It's been in development for a while, but we're just getting started with it. So I'm not really at liberty to tell you much. It's time for him to get back on the boards and for us to get back on the boards together again. He's been busy. He's been very busy writing and writing. And script doctoring for other people, and he has that ability what was the movie he wrote for Tony Scott?
Domino. That's like one of my favorite. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. I'm a Tony Scott disciple, one of the highlights of my life was getting a chance to intern for Tony, and when I was there, that was when Domino was being researched and written. So I can remember seeing early drafts of the script floating around and seeing sort of conceptual art. And I can remember him talking about Richard Kelly and how much he loved working with him, and how Kelly was always changing things up and making, you know, giving Tony a run for his money and the whole thing. So, I'm a huge fan of that film.
I am too. I think it deserved a bigger life than it got, but that happens with so many movies. But what a ride. What a ride.
Yeah, it's like the apex for me of like Tony Scott's aesthetic. And from a cinematography point of view, that movie is like I'm not a cinematographer, but I would have to imagine that's just a quintessential cinematographer's film in terms of the various, tricks that he was pulling and the attention to detail and the varying speeds and, you know, different types of film stocks he was using. Very, you know, inspired by the stuff that, you know, I always felt that it was hit. His Oliver Stone movie, he kind of like was Tony Scott unleashed. Soulmates, it's awesome to hear just the title, because if you take Richard Kelly and then the phrase Soulmates and new project, you can definitely be left to your own imagination to maybe see where something like that might be going. Want to ask you too, because I feel like I'd be remiss if we didn't say something. You have served on some guilds, some cinematographer guilds, and right now, you know, you are the president of the International Cinematographers Guild. When we say that, what does that mean? What does that constitute for you?
You know, I came out of a union background in Chicago only because my mentor from the time I was 14 was a strong union member. I had aunts and uncles who were in the early days. I guess you would call them socialists, although that word never was mentioned. Maybe even deeper, who knows? But I came out of a in my youth, I was involved with the Jewish Community Centers, which was a kind of a lefty organization, although that's not how it was sold. But we went to summer camp where we learned union songs and freedom songs, and it was just built into my upbringing, although it was never verbalized that way. When it came time for me to become a union member, my mentor, Maury Bleckman, who was a newsreel cameraman in Chicago, made me promise that when I got in the union, that I would spend the entire first year going to the meetings. They have monthly meetings with a bunch of old guys sitting around getting free dinners. And I would go to the meetings, and he said, spend an entire year, go every month if you can, keep your mouth shut and just listen. And I did. I came in an odd way and came in as a director of photography or as a cinematographer, which was very unusual at the time, was not very well liked. But within 2 years, I became vice president of the organization. It started my concern for trade unionism in an active way. And then the other thing that happened that was kind of influential was when I was doing Life Stinks for Mel Brooks, around 1990, I think it was, I was asked to do an experimental piece for Panavision, Sony, and the TV network, the giant TV network, NHK in Japan, where they were testing out their first, one of their first cameras that was not film. It wasn't digital yet, it was analog, but they wanted to do a test. And I kind of said initially, well, listen, I'm doing a movie and I'm not really interested. And for whatever reason, they wanted me bad enough, they said, well, we'll wait to do it. So I finished the movie with Mel Brooks, which was another absolute highlight of my career, working with the man. They were ready for me, and I said to them, well, where's the script? And they said, script? And they said, well, what story are we doing? You're trying to do an experiment where you show that this camera can be used to make motion pictures. We have to shoot a story. Oh, you know, the Japanese, very formal, and they said, oh, okay. And then I said, who's the director? And they looked at me and they said, director? And I said, well, yeah, I mean, we're going to be able to shoot a story, little story. What are we going to do to have a director and a script and a narrative and show that this camera can be used? We ended up making a 15-minute short. It cost about almost $1 million, which they weren't planning on doing. When I finally said, what were you expecting me to do with this camera that you want to shoot movies with? And they said, well, we thought you'd go out on the beach with a few pretty girls and just shoot shots. And I said, well, then I don't want to do this because that's not a test. And they ended up going along with me. We made this test. It was analog at the time. It was cumbersome. We needed a truck to follow us to record the material. Toward the end, we got the first digital recorder for high def that Sony made, and we went out on the road and did this little short, this bicycle short. Well, I became very interested, realizing that this was coming. It wasn't ready. It was still very new and cumbersome, but we were able to do a little film that I thought looked pretty good, and I knew, I felt in my bones that this was coming on us, and it was going to come on us very quickly. And I got involved because I realized at that point that the whole concept of what a director of photography is could be lost in the process. And I became very concerned with it and started over the next 10 years became an international spokesman about this process and was very critical of it, to the point where I was thought of as being against digital shooting, against high definition, which I wasn't. I was just pushing to make it better, to the point where I thought that it was good enough that we could use it to shoot movies. There was a tremendous amount of pushback by the companies from that, especially Sony at the time, because they wanted to get it out on the market and it wasn't ready. So having become very involved in that process and having a certain amount of trepidation that the entire process of being a cinematographer was going to change radically, I started my crusade to try and save the art and craft of cinematography. I had been a member of the ASC, which was a fraternal organization, very exclusive. I had been a member since Someone to Watch Over Me, around 1984-85. And because I'm an activist, I got on the board and was a vice president for a number of years. And I saw the opportunity to get involved. I became president for a term and kind of shook things up in there because they didn't think digital would ever happen, and was a little too progressive for them. So I left after the first term. And then over a couple of years later, a situation happened where there was a void at the union. I, being an activist, stepped up and ran for office. And actually, truth be told, I impeached the president that was in. Not with the intention of becoming president, but when I turned around, we had 30, once that happened, and there were three of us that did this action, and it was righteous. It was correct. Once that happened, we had 30 days to elect a president to finish the term. And I turned to all my friends who had pushed me into doing this and said, okay, well, you'll become president. No, 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 you should become president. No, no, no. And finally, I had to put my money where my mouth was. And 30 days later, I was voted in as president of the union. Now, at that time, there were about 6,000 members. We're now up to, what is it, 9 years, third to finishing my third term. We are up to 7,600, 7,800 members. It's grown tremendously. It's one of the success stories of trade unionism, because most unions have lost membership and have become minimalized, and it's a tragedy in this country what's happening to trade unionism. It's starting to come back now, but the IATSE, I'm very proud to say, has grown in stature, has grown in strength, and because there is a worldwide voracious market for media right now, they need us, and they need the professionalism and the structure of this trade union to accomplish what it is that the producers want to put out there. And there's this huge market worldwide. So we're busy. We're busy across the country. Everybody thought that, when New York became busy, and when Atlanta or Georgia became busy, and Louisiana and Michigan and all these other states that had incentives, that Los Angeles dropped off. Los Angeles never was slow. What happened was it was a different kind of work that started happening here, and that's changing now because now we have incentives that are equal and as good or better than some. But during that time, the town was still busy, but what it was doing was smaller stuff. It wasn't getting the big features. It wasn't getting the lot of the television left, but all the reality came here. All the commercials came here, and so there was still a busyness. Now, you can't even find parking places on studio lots. It's that busy, and everybody's working. It's a good environment right now.
That's awesome.
This all sounds fantastic. That's great.
Activist. I got a big mouth, and I'm an activist, and I've been very involved. I'm proud to say, in the development and implementation of digital cinematography, and I'm involved with the Motion Picture Academy, which has now developed the new color space called ACES, which is going to be a tremendous solution to workflow where. There's a great disparity in cameras. Each camera has its own method of creating a workflow. My friend Leon Silverman, who now is a vice president at Disney for digital, he said that workflows are like snowflakes. No two are alike, and the minute they hit the ground, they disappear. And yeah. For years, that's what it's been like. You had to develop a workflow for every project you did. We're finally getting to the point where cameras are so good, the digital methodology is developing. And now we have this new envelope to put all the material in and fit it all in. So whatever camera you use can fit into this world and be used and be demonstrably similar in their ways of so you could take a GoPro and an Alexa or a Canon C500 and make it all work within the same visual framework. So it's an exciting time. It's a very exciting time.
Wow. That's awesome. I know we're running out of time with you, but I feel like it's my duty to ask you about your collaboration with Mel Brooks, because Mel Brooks is just one of the greatest men who's ever lived.
One of the greatest. I was introduced to Mel's work when I was 12 years old from the album The 2000-Year-Old Man. That was so influential in my life. I memorized it. I knew it. When I first came to Hollywood from Chicago, I was a student at Art Center, and I found out his address, and I wrote a letter to him saying, "I will do anything for you. I will sweep floors. I really would like to work with you." And I went to his house, and I put the envelope in the mailbox. And I actually got a letter back from him saying, "Sorry, there's nothing available now," whatever. And so I put it to bed and developed myself as a cinematographer and went along my career. I was working on Rocky V, and Rocky V had its problems, and it was and I had my problems at the time with a woman that I was with, you know, it's life, and decided I was going to take the summer off after finishing with Rocky V, and I just was going to do commercials and relax for a little bit. Well, the week I finished that movie, I finished working on that movie, a friend of mine who worked for Mel as a writer, one of his two writers at the time, called me up. I had just gotten off a plane from a commercial that I was doing, and I got a call, early cell phones, and he said, "Would you be interested in working with Mel Brooks?" And I said, "Of course I would." And he said, okay, well, we'll get the script over to your house. We just lost the guy who was going to shoot the movie. He didn't get along with Mel, and Mel is looking for somebody, and I put you up for it. By the time I drove home from the airport, there was a script waiting at my door. It was on a Sunday. I read the script. Sunday night, I called my friend and said, I'd love to work with Mel on this movie. It was, you know, a comedy about the homeless. Well, my twisted mind said, this is a great idea. And I called my friend and I said, okay, I'd like to come in and meet with him. So a meeting was arranged Monday morning. And I got in the room, and both of the writers and the producer were there, and Mel was there. And I in talking to them, I told him my history with him about writing him a letter, and I really wanted to work with him. But I said to him, Mel, I just came off of this difficult situation. I wasn't going to do a movie this summer, but you're my comic hero, and I want to work with you. But I got to make a deal. He said, okay, what's the deal? And I said, I know from all my friends who have worked for you in the past that you yell and scream at cameramen. And he said, yeah, I do. And I said, well, here's the deal. You're allowed to yell and scream at me, but you got to be nice. And he turned to everybody else in the room and he said, he says I got to be nice. Okay, I think I can do that. So he said, we finished the conversation, and he said, oh, I'll call you later. Now, we had 5 days. It was Monday. We had four more days before we were going to start shooting the movie, which meant that there was no prep whatsoever for me. So I'm sitting at home that afternoon. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the phone rings. I pick it up. He says, hi, it's Mel. And it was like no secretary or anything. It was just direct. You know, that's the way he is. Hi, it's Mel. He said, we want you to come in tomorrow and go scouting with us so I can, so we can tell if you're a prima donna or not. And I screamed into the phone. He said, I'm not a prima donna. Whoever else was in the room, he turned to them and said, he says he's not a prima donna. So I came in the next day, and it was a romance. It was wonderful all the way through the project. But he is tough, you know, and he's in it. He's directing. He's neurotic, as you would expect Mel to be, is wonderful. He would come in every single morning and get in my face and scream at me in front of everybody, right? And, you know, you have no idea what you're doing. You have no sense of comedy. You're costing me millions of dollars. And I would sit there and laugh because this is the 2,000-year-old man, a man I'd loved at a distance all this time, yelling at me. And it was the 2,000-year-old man yelling at me. How could I take it seriously? And that went on literally almost every morning. Halfway through the movie, he came to me and he said, Stephen, I want you to know something. You're doing a good job. And he said, I come in and I yell at you every morning, but I want you to know something. I'm not yelling at you. I'm yelling at them, but they can't take it and you can. That was it. That was the M.O., And we've remained friendly since then. Every time I see him, he's a delight. He's still as active and as creative as you could possibly imagine. I don't know if you saw the special that he did on was it HBO? Just standing up there talking with energy and enthusiasm and comedy just coming out of his pores. He's a genius, and he's a wonderful man. The first time he met my wife, which was a few years ago, we were at a small club because Carl Reiner's daughter sings, and we were there and she happens to be a colleague of my wife's, and we were all there, and Mel was there. It was the first time I'd seen him in a long time, and I introduced him to my wife. And he looked up at her. He was sitting down. He looked up at her and said, you're beautiful. You know you could have done much better. So, I mean, that's him. He's just a delight, true delight.
That's incredible.
I conned him, by the way. I conned him.
How did you con him?
He said, He said, you know, this is a movie about the homeless, and it's Los Angeles, and it's hot, and it's terrible out, and it, these people are living in the alleys, and I don't want any of that filter shit. Don't give me any of that diffusion. Well, I happen to use diffusion on everything I shoot. Just part of my style. So,
is that why everything looks so dreamy?
Well, maybe you call it dreamy, but it depends on the movie. There, it's each one is different. I don't do the same thing each time, but
no,
yes.
But there's a consistency to some of your work that I have noticed, that does sort of stress I don't know if it's an atmospheric quality, but there's certainly in the Richard Kelly stuff. I mean, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to ask.
But it's true. And how about Spread? Spread was a beautiful look at Hollywood.
Frank and I, like, when we talk to these guests that have such amazing credits, hopefully you'll come back on and we can do like a volume two, because we didn't get to, you know, a whole bunch of stuff. So hopefully you've enjoyed yourself enough. We can have another chat. Spread is very underrated. It looks fantastic. It's another really cool film from David McKenzie, who's made a career out of making these very interesting films. He's a very, very interesting up and coming filmmaker.
A terrific filmmaker, and I hope to work with him again. He's been working with a friend of mine, Michael Bedono, lately, because they're Irish. Michael is and he's Scottish, and Arthur's Scottish, and so they've been working together. But I hope I get a chance to work with him again. I really enjoyed it. But let me finish the con, okay? Because Mel says, I don't want any of that filtered junk on your dinner. No one on that. So I said, Mel, look at. You know how the ozone layer has been dispersing, and we have much more ultraviolet light. He said, yeah. I said, I have to use ultraviolet filters to take that ultraviolet haze away. And he said, all right, you can use ultraviolet filters, but don't make them too heavy. And I said, and the other thing I do is take the glare off of people's skins with a polarizer, and that won't diffuse anything. He said, okay, fine, you can use that. But none of this filter shit, okay? So I took all of my diffusion filters that I wanted to use, and I relabeled them ultraviolet. So my crew knew, and we were, of course, using it. And halfway through the movie, he came to me and he said, you know those ultraviolet filters you're using? And I said, yeah. He said, use more of them on my close-ups. he knew what I was doing. He knew perfectly well what I was doing. He liked it. So it was a very, it had a romantic look to it. And it was appropriate for the time, I think.
Wow. That's awesome.
Great. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you guys.
Yeah, thank you so very much for coming on. This has been unbelievable.
Yeah, Stephen, it goes without saying, thank you very much. I mean, it's been an informative, very passionate discussion. It's abundantly clear how much the process and how much this, you know, your profession means to you personally. And, you know, we really do hope to get you back on the show down the road and talk about, you know, more of your stuff, because there's just so much great stuff you've been a part of, and you've got some really cool stuff coming out, you know, in the next, you know, few months, really. I mean, we're almost now at the end of the year. So 2016 is almost here.
Yeah. Unfortunately, here it comes. But I'll tell you something. I'm very, very fortunate to have had the career I do. I still, to this day, love every single moment that I get to do it. It's just that much of me. I wanted to do this since I was a teenager. I still feel like I'm a teenager in some ways. I love it. I love delving into the technology, but mostly I love delivering the art.
Well, thank you for giving us so many great things to look at and to experience, you know, cinematically, because, you know, you've had a hand in some amazing stuff. So thank you very much for coming on, and you can definitely bet we'll be keeping in touch.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.